Okay, I think everybody did. I think I've scared everybody away from the class then.
I know.
We shall see what happens. Let me see if I can use the front board for a moment. Okay, I just wanted to project a little bit more about genetic drift. This is just an example of what I showed you in the run that we did of PopG last time, where I showed you the gene frequency spreading out. This is produced with the same and different version of the same programs, where I could also keep track of the average gene frequency among the lines, and also of the variance among the lines and of the heterozygosity, the average heterozygosity within populations. So we have genetic drift. It's starting at frequency 0.3 right here. There are eight, how many lines? Eight lines. And you see them spreading out. One goes up rather quickly. One goes down rather quickly. The population size here is very small, n equal 10. But any larger population size just works proportionately. That is, it goes through more or less the same changes, but in correspondingly longer time. So n equal 100 is like this diagram, only it's 10 times long. It's instead of going 0 to 40 generations, you'd have down here 0 to 400 generations, and you get more or less the same changes. Likewise, population of size 1,000, it would be 0 to 4,000 generations. So that's one of the nice properties, is that it's not exactly proportional, but it's so close that you can regard it that way. This projector is failing, so I will use older technology. And I always like to point out, I don't know if I told you this story, but if I did please forgive me, that I gave a lecture in Nova Scotia once at a molecular evolution conference that was held in the Fisheries Museum in the fishing town of Lunenburg. And in the auditorium, for a pointer, they gave you to use a seal harpoon with a very wicked point on the front. You had to be very careful not to poke it through the screen. This is just a stick. Okay. So the populations are spreading apart, but their average is just these dots, and it's wobbling some because there's 10 populations. If you had 100 populations, it would look similar in many more lines, but the averages wouldn't be wandering very much. They'd be much closer to the original frequency, and so on. So larger and larger number of different populations you're watching, the more nearly it is that their average will just be staying the same. If you look at the variance among lines, among these eight lines, it starts here and goes up, and then it's kind of wobbling. In the limit, when 30% of them fix and 70% of them get lost, it should come to 0.21, which is this level right here. So you see, it's not quite got there, but it's somewhere near it. The number of lines that have fixed up is 1 at this point. The number of lines that fixed down is 4. And of the remaining 8, these 3 here, these two guys might go up. That would be 3 out of 8, or maybe one of them would come down. So the variance among lines, as the gene frequencies are spreading out, and that's measuring that, the amount of variability within lines is going down as the gene frequencies get closer to fixation or loss. And that's measured by the heterozygosity here coming down and then wandering a bit, but still trending down. It's supposed to come down in a nice exponential decay, geometric decay. It doesn't quite. With eight replicates, you don't get exactly what you expect. So that's an example. Let me show you. In a moment, I will talk about the Wright-Fisher model a little bit more exactly. But here, when you use the model and you work out the probabilities of all the things that happen, you can work out, you can set up a matrix that shows the probability of changing from I copies to J copies of the gene, whatever I and J are. So you can start, one row of the matrix would be starting with 6 copies of the gene, what's the probability in the next generation of getting 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, up to, in this case, 20, there's a population size 10, and using that matrix and multiplying it by itself in the right way, you can work out from a starting point of, say, for 30%, which is the initial frequency here, same as the simulation, that would be 6 copies. Starting out with 6 copies, initially everybody would be sitting on 6. There'd be a spike. The distribution of different population gene frequencies would just be a spike sitting at 6. After 2 generations, they are expected to spread out like this. Now, that would be what would happen with an infinite number of replicates. But it's what you calculate with the matrix, with the transition probability matrix of going from I copies to J copies. And there's the calculation. So you see this spread out. Not quite normal, because, of course, it's not normal. It's a little bit skewed, and it can't go past 0 or 1. If you go forward 10 generations, which, let's just look back. Here, 10 generations is at this point. So you see some reaching of fixation, but a lot of them wobbling around in the middle. And if you look here, what you expect with larger numbers of replicates is they're spread out rather smoothly between 0 and 1, with a spike at 0 and a little developing spike at 1. And you go further forward 40 generations, which is the end of that plot, and you would get a lot of them are expected to have lost the big A and a smaller number to have fixed the big A. In the end, 30% of them will fix big A. 30% is here, so it isn't quite to that level. So this is the calculations using a transition probability matrix for the right model, which is you can set up and crank it numerically. There are not known formulas for these. For this one, you could sort of do it with a great big summation. For this, it gets ugly, but there aren't simple analytical formulas for those. There's a whole technology called diffusion processes that gets us some more formulas for that sort of thing. But this will give you a feel for what genetic drift is doing. On average, it's not changing the gene frequencies, but in each particular case, the gene frequencies are wandering further and further. Okay. I want to go. Oh, that'll be the only projection. So let me put the lights on and raise the screen and try to persuade the projector to turn itself on. And if I can do that, yeah. It actually did turn itself off. That's astonishing. The Wright-Fisher model is a model in which, as I explained, and as you understand, the probability of getting a good pin, of getting J copies, given that you have I copies now, so this is now, and this is next generation, is equal to the current, it's the binomial probability with the number of tosses equal to the number of copies. For a diploid population, that'd be 2n tosses. So it's 2n tosses with probability p, which is equal to the number of copies over 2n. Okay. Now, the formula for the binomial probability is a thing you might have seen in a probability class. It's combinations of two things, j at a time, times p to the j times 1 minus p to the 2n minus j. So it's just that's the ordinary binomial probability. It's not that critical. We won't directly be using it, but that's very simple. And what it means is, given I and j, you can work out this matrix of the probability of going from I to j. And you can work out that whole thing. You will find a section in the notes where I talk about how you then multiply those matrices by themselves to get, if I want to work out the graphs that I just showed you, come from numerically cranking on those probabilities. They're actually are not, as I said, exact formulas for them. Okay. Now what I want to do is say, well, we have this process. We can say things about how quickly the gene frequencies spread. We can say less about exactly how soon they reach fixation and loss, but we know that in the long run, a fraction, 0.3 of them, will go to fixation if they start at the gene frequency 0.3, and 0.7 will lose. But we don't have the exact formulas, for example, for what fraction are fixed at various numbers of generations. But you can do it numerically for any particular case you want. You don't have a formula in terms of n and the initial starting frequency. But you can create these matrices, fill them with the right numbers, and then crank them on a computer, and you can figure out the expected fraction fixed at each generation. It's all that's all straightforward. Okay. What Sewell Wright did was to look at variances and look at probabilities of identity, what we now call probabilities of identity by descent, or their counterpart, probabilities of non-identity by descent. And those give you the general picture. Those give you a real, very concrete feeling for how much the gene frequencies are spreading out on their way to fixation and how much the within population heterozygosity is decreasing. I should say one thing about that process. Many people say, well, these are becoming inbred. And then they make the mistake of saying, therefore, if we look in a population, we'll see a departure from Hardy-Weinberg proportions, because after all, they're inbred. There'll be more homozygotes and less heterozygotes. I guess I'm going to question you. Can you tell me whether, I've kind of hinted what's the answer, but can you tell me whether that's true? If I have a population in which everybody marries their cousin, I'll get offspring that are inbred. There'll be more homozygotes in that population than we would expect from Hardy-Weinberg proportions. Okay, that's true. Now suppose instead the inbreeding of the population arose by genetic drift. Nobody's preferentially marrying relatives. They're just going out and randomly running into each other. But of course, in a finite population, everybody ultimately becomes a relative. Let me say, why is it true? Why can it be true that we don't expect to see departures from Hardy-Weinberg? How do we resolve the following paradox? The paradox is every population is random mating individuals. These individuals occurred by random mating. overall, there is a deficit of heterozygotes as the drift, as the populations drift. But yet they're not out of Hardy-Weinberg. So what's, how do we put that together? Yes.
Well,
thank you for your courage.
So I think my point of confusion lies that for Hardy-Weinberg, like one of the like assumptions is an infinite population size.
That's true, certainly
and
true.
And so how do you get genetic drift in an infinite population size?
Well, you, I mean, naively and simply, you don't.
Okay.
Okay, so the gene frequency just, but remember, in an infinite population, the gene frequency remains exactly the same forever and ever, without, unless there's some other evolutionary force. Mm-hmm. In these populations, there's no other evolutionary forces, but they're finite. Because of random sampling of gametes, the gene frequencies in each population are changing, and they are becoming different. Now, overall, let me see if I can rationalize this. If you were to judge by the overall gene frequency, which is the same as the initial gene frequency, if you have many, many replicates, the overall gene frequency isn't changing. Each individual gene frequency is changing. Okay. Judging by the overall gene frequency, making Hardy-Weinberg expectations from that, there are far too few heterozygotes. That is, for example, if you go all the way to where they all fix or get lost, there are no heterozygotes whatsoever. If you're judging by the initial frequency, there ought to be some heterozygotes. So you have a deficit of heterozygotes. But looking at any one population, you're using its gene frequency, and then you compute Hardy-Weinberg proportions, you'll be pretty close. Within that population, they have randomated at that gene frequency. So there is a deficit of heterozygotes, but it's a matter of relative to what you initially had and relative to that overall frequency. But within each population, they're just mating at random. You'll find a gene frequency, say, of 0.9 in one of those populations. And there will be Hardy-Weinberg proportions that are pretty close to the expectations for 0.9. But there'll be another one over here that's got a gene frequency of 0.1, and it'll have it'll have genotype frequencies that are near Hardy-Weinberg for that. And we know, I gave you examples, where when you combine populations that have different gene frequencies and look at the newly combined individuals, are they in Hardy-Weinberg proportions? Well, in the numerical examples you had, they weren't. In fact, there were deficits of heterozygotes. The example I gave you of Belgravia and Ruritania showed that. It was a rather small effect, but it did show that. So, yes, there's a deficit of heterozygotes overall. No, in each population, you do still expect to find locally Hardy-Weinberg proportions at that local gene frequency. I don't know if I've made any sense here, but I'll have to leave it at that. So what I want to do from here is to spend the rest of this lecture on the issue of effective population size, which is also the... Excuse me while I change batteries here. I don't want to have the recording interrupted. We'll have two. I have two audio files that I'll have to stitch together, but that's not the biggest problem in the world. Okay, I want to talk about effective population size, and I want to indicate how certain departures from this idealized Wright-Fisher model affect the rate of genetic drift and the rate of decline in average heterozygosity. And the buildup of identity by descent. And the way you do that is that you figure out what's happening to the identity by descent, and then you say the effect of population size will be whatever population size, rather than the actual size, whatever fictional size will give you that identity by descent. So let me take a simple case, and that is no selfing. Suppose that it's the same model as before, but now what we're going to do is when we come to produce an individual here, we will pick a parent at random, and then we'll pick another parent at random, but not allowing ourselves to pick the first one. Okay, what will then happen? I'm not going to work the whole thing out because we're running late in the course and I haven't got time, but it's right there in the section in the notes, you can go over it. And what you get is a, let me see, sorry. Yeah, you get that you need to follow not one but two quantities, one of which is the identity by descent within an individual. This is in generation T plus one, between the two copies in an individual, and the other is the probability of identity by descent between copies that are in two different individuals. It turns out those are no longer the same quantity they were in the simple model. And then you get formulas for them. You get that the H in generation T plus one is the K in the previous generation, and the K is, see if I get this exactly right, 1 over 2n times H plus 1 minus 1 over n times k. And I should say, these are probabilities, the way I'm doing it now, of non-IBD, which you then, of course, can immediately translate back into probabilities of IBD. Now you look at that and say, oh, I don't know what it's going to do. It's a little system of linear equations. You can set it up in matrices. You can do all the matrix machinery that people who like matrices know and love. I should have given you a trigger warning of matrices. And I should drop the cap of the pen. But you can also do it in a simpler way. You can say, well, any HIC could be replaced by the K from the preceding generation. And that will give you K T plus 1 equals 1 over 2n K of T minus 1 and 1 minus 1 over n of K T. In other words, these K quantities can be worked out in terms of the K of the two preceding generations. I'm not giving you the argument. I'm not giving you where all the terms came from. And then you can say, well, if you plot this thing out, what you will find is that the K declines, but it does so at a somewhat irregular rate, and then after a little bit it smooths out and it goes down geometrically. For those into the matrix math, that's a matter of two different eigenvalues, and one is a lot smaller than the other and dies away. And you can say, well, what is this asymptotic rate of decay of K going to be? And for that, you can say, well, what if every generation K is a multiple of the previous K, which is a multiple, which is that same quantity squared of the K before that, and you plug those into the equations, what you end up getting out is a quadratic equation. And the quadratic equation looks like this. It's lambda squared minus 1 minus 1 over n times lambda minus 1 over 2n equals 0. And you look at that and say, well, that's fun, but, you know, what can we do with that? Well, you just solve the quadratic with the usual formulas. And what you get is lambda is, trying to get this right, is 1 minus 1 over n plus the plus or minus the square root of 1 minus 1 over this quantity n squared all over 2. And you look at that and you say, well, it still doesn't look particularly, particularly illuminating. But what you can say also, doing a little expanding of these and throwing away small terms, you ultimately end up saying it's very close to 1 over 1 minus 1 over 2n plus 1, the quantity 2n plus 1. Okay, and now you look at that and say, well, what was it before in the original model that allowed something? That was 1 minus 1 over 2n. So all that's happened is that 2n has been had a 1 added to it. And if you say to yourself, okay, I want to know a population size, a fictional population size, that will give you the same rate of decay of non-identity by descent, which will be, of course, the same rate of buildup of identity by descent. Well, it's done by putting a little e on this number and saying, in the idealized model that allows selfing, what effective population size would we have to have? What would the population size have to be to match this? And the answer, of course, is that 2NE should be equal to 2N plus 1, or NE equal to N plus a half. So right away you get a quick feel. If I have a population of size 100 and I say no selfing allowed, and we undergo random genetic drift in that population without selfing allowed, I will get the same rate of decay as if the population was not of size 100, but size of 100.5. So it'll add, in effect, it'll slow down the loss of identity by descent as if the population were half an individual larger. And there's some discussion in the notes here about what's the exact formula and how far off is this. And the short answer is it's very, very good approximation. So if I had a population of size 1,000,000 and I banned selfing, all I'd be doing was slowing down genetic drift by as if it were 1,000,000 plus 0.5 of an individual. In other words, it wouldn't make much difference. It'll make very, very little difference to the loss of identity by descent. So there is the concept of effective population size. It's the population size of the idealized model that has selfing allowed and everything that would give you the same rate of loss as you actually find in these in the analysis of the particular model. Okay, so that's one thing, no selfing. Now, another one that's much more fun is separate sexes. Someone can say, well, look, the idealized model doesn't distinguish between males and females. When you put together two gametes, they're just drawn from two random individuals. What if we had a population instead that had N sub F females? And I'll draw them as squares, kind of like pedigree style. N sub M males. And then we require, when we're making a new individual, you again draw random parents, but now you have to put the restriction on that says the first one you draw has to be a female and the second one has to be a male. So it can't be the same individual. Of course, they can't solve. You draw one of these NF females as the parent and one of these NM males, and that's what you use to make an offspring. And you make NF that are females, and then you make another NM and call those males. Okay. So there's the model. When you do the analysis of this, which I will not do in detail, you again find you need a probability of non-identity by descent within individuals and a probability between individuals. So you've got an H and a K again. It doesn't matter whether it's within males or within females, because you made the males and females by the same process. And likewise, it doesn't matter whether the two individuals that you're looking between when you're between two individuals are the same sex or different sexes. And you can set up the equations, and they come out. Let's keep this one here because for a very important reason in this green box. That was the equation for the no selfing allowed. Now I'm going to go over here and I'm going to say the equations come out to be the first equation comes out to be H sub T plus 1 equals K. H equals the K of the previous generation, just like it did before. But the second one is a little trickier, and the argument is in the notes. And it is K T plus 1 equals 1 over 8 N sub F plus 1 over 8 N sub M whole thing times H plus 1 minus 1 over 4 NF minus 1 over 4 NM times K. And if you look at that and say, okay, let's take it that turns out to be the result. Gosh, it's going to be more complicated to analyze, isn't it? And until somebody looks at it and says, wait a second, I just noticed something about this equation. If we take this here at a 1 over 2n, this has got some 1 over 8n's, this at a 1 over n, that's got some 1 over 4n's, and we can say that these equations are the same if 1 over n is replaced by, see if I can get this right, 1 over 4 N sub M plus 1 over 4 N sub F. If you replace in this formula over here this thing, this 1 over anywhere you see a 1 over N by this thing, you get that equation. And we know the answer. We know the answer for this equation in the green box. We just did it. We'll say that the effective population size will be n plus a half, but what's n? N is the result of this thing. It will be 1 over the quantity 1 over 4 n m plus 1 over 4 n f, and then there's a little plus a half on the end. So what we have now is an effective population size in terms of the numbers of males and females. And that's interesting. And what it also means is that we can explore the issue of what if you have more females than males, what if you have more males than females, what if you have equal numbers of them? If you have equal numbers of them, then if NM, let me make a table and show you. This kind of thing here where you take the reciprocals of things and then you average them and then you take the reciprocal and go back to the original scale is called a harmonic mean. But let me show you. This is a table in the book. So, suppose I have 100 individuals overall, and I have 50 females and 50 males, and I plug into this formula, what I'm going to get is 1 over 200 plus 1 over 200. That comes out to be the same as 1 over 100, and then you turn it upside down. The effective population size will be the same as it would be if you had the no-selfing case with this 100 individuals. So it's 100.5. Now suppose you took 25 of one sex and 75 of the other. So now we have fewer females and more males, or we could be going the other way as well. And now it turns out to be 75.5, just plugging into the formula. With 10 and 90, it becomes 36.5. With 5 and 95, it becomes 19.5. And in the limit, with 1 and 99, 4.46. Basically, when the numbers of the sexes are unequal in either direction, just a second, it gets to be the number, the effective size gets very close to 4 times the rarer sex. And plus, then there's a little plus a half. Yeah.
So this is assuming that the female has 99 offspring and all of the males have one offspring?
No. If you have one female and 99 males, each time you produce an offspring, you pick among the females. Well, there's only one female.
Okay.
So she'll have all the offspring.
Okay.
And the males have, there are 99 of them, and each one will get a chance to be the father of each offspring.
So
on average, the average male will have 100 over 99 offspring, a little bit more than one offspring. But you see, when you have only one female and everybody has to have a mother and a father,
so
that female must be the mother of everybody.
So I guess my question is, does the female have more offspring than the males?
Yes.
Okay.
There are fewer females. That means the females are going to have more offspring per individual.
Got it.
Same thing holds if we have the imbalance go the other way. If we had only one male and 99 females, it would work the same way. And the numbers will come out the same. So although I've gone off here, I've gone in the direction of having fewer females. I think the book, what I plot in the notes is the other part of the table where you go in the direction of fewer males. And it's just the same numbers flipped. Yes?
And each pair produce two offspring?
No. You're picking a pair and producing one offspring, then you're throwing them back. The next time you pick, you could get the same individuals. On average, each parent, well, when there are equal numbers of the two sexes, on average, each parent has two offspring. They get chosen twice. The pairs are just put together for the purpose of having one offspring. And then they go back and get to try again.
And then you do this n child?
You would do it n times, yeah. You do it n times. You do it n sub f times and call those females. Then you do it another n sub m times and call it males. So you'll see that the analysis in terms of the effective population size is actually very easy. It's just a quick realization that these two equations are the same, and look for what quantity plays the same role as n. And then you get this thing, the effective population size formula here. And it shows you that whichever sex is rarer, the effective size is about 4 times the number of the individuals in that sex. And when they're equal, the effective size is the same as it would be in the no-selfing allowed case with the same number of individuals. Namely, in this case, 100.5. Okay. So that's with different numbers of the two sexes. Let me do another case, and I'm going to be running out of... cases, but you will also have a homework where you will be struggling with this, and I'm sorry to have given you a homework that you'll have to struggle with, but just know that don't sit down an hour before you're going to turn it in and start then. It'll work out. Okay, what about another case? In all of these cases here, we've assumed that the number of individuals in the population is staying the same from one generation to the next. What happens if it varies? Let's go back to the selfing allowed idealized case with no distinction between sexes, because that's easiest to do. So I'm going to have to erase something here, and I'm going to erase all the stuff in the middle, all of which you will, of course, find in the notes in greater detail. And I'm going to say, let's suppose we have population size changing through time. You know, it's going down, it's going up, it's doing whatever it's doing from one generation to another. Now, it might strike you that it is incredibly hard to think about a case like that. But I want to argue that it isn't. For simple discrete generations models, which we're using, it's actually rather easy. Because remember, back to that selfing allowed case, you just had one non-identity by descent, and every generation it got multiplied, for the diploid case, by 1 minus 1 over 2n. Okay, that was easy, that was simple. Now n is changing. So you have to sort of think for a moment, what n was it that was involved there? And it was the number of individuals in the parent generation. Because it came from a consideration that when you chose gametes from the parent generation, what was the chance that they would be, that you would get the same gamete chosen twice? And the answer is it's 1 over twice the number of parents. Now you put that together and you just say, well, we'll start out with some h sub 0, usually that's a 1, and every generation, well, let's call the parent generation, yeah, generation 0, the original parent, and then each generation you multiply it by 1 over 1 minus 1 over 2n, except the n keeps changing. So on, and forward you go until you get 1 minus 1 over 2 times the previous generation. Okay. So it's just a product of those. So actually life is very simple. And then you want to say, okay, what is effective population size? Well, the answer is, in the original idealized model, which had constant population sizes, it's whatever constant population size would give you this amount of multiplication of H. And what is that? That's equal to 1 minus 1 over 2NE, where that NE is the thing we're looking for. Multiply this number of times. Actually, the way I've set it up here, there are t plus 1 factors here because I called the first generation 0. And I think in the notes I do it as t generations, so there's a little off by 1 between what I'm doing on the board and what's in the notes. So, you can just say, well then, if there are t generations, this had t plus 1, but let's go back to t. If there are t generations, solve 1 minus 1 over 2 and e raised to the t power, the product, this is a big symbol for the product of 1 minus 1 over 2 n's. Let's call that I. And you can take logs and solve it, and the expression is not terribly illuminating. But the other thing you can do is do something, and this was done by Sewell Wright in the mid-1930s. He said, well, if n is big, if these are biggish populations, then when we take this product of 1 minus 1 over 2n's, this thing, it's going to have a leading term, which is 1 times 1 times 1 times 1 all the way across. Then it's going to have some terms that have one of these 1 over 2n's in it. So it'll be 1 minus 1 over 2n 1 minus 1 over 2n 2, blah, 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 minus 1 over 2n t. And then there'll be some terms that involve 1 over n squareds, and some terms involve 1 over n cubes, and so on. But if n is large, those terms won't be making much of a contribution. The result of that, and also this thing, you can do a similar thing, and it's approximately 1 minus t over 2ne plus some terms that we're going to drop. And when you solve for that, the effective size with the n's varying is 1 over the sum over all your generations of 1 over the n for that generation, all divided by t. What does that mean? That means you take all your n's, you take their reciprocals, you go on to the reciprocal scale, you get 1 over each number, and then you average them. So it's the, what's the so-called harmonic mean? Of the n's. Now, you might say, well, so what? I mean, well, how's it different from just averaging the n's? Well, no, you're averaging your reciprocals of the n's. And it turns out the weighting of things that are big and things that are small is very much different in this formula. What I'll start off next time in doing, but we're not going to be able to continue talking about effective population size, is to show you that the effective population size will be much closer to the small n's than to the big n's. It won't be like an arithmetic average. The times when the population is small will cause a lot of genetic drift, and that will be more influential. And there's a table in the notes where I imagine a population that's at two sizes and spends different numbers of generations at each, and you can see, if you look through that, you can see how it works. There also is material, there's a subsection on varying fertility. Suppose some individuals are contributing many more offspring than others. And the answer is that also lowers the effective population size. So if a few individuals hit the jackpot, it's much more like a population that's that small than than the full-size population. So I'm afraid I ran you out of time earlier in the quarter, so we're not going to get a chance to talk about that very much. So particular bottlenecks within a population, and also variations in fertility from individual to individual, lower the effective population size. Yeah, we're really out of time, but let me take the question.
The average in the past T generation?
It's the reciprocal of the average of reciprocals. You go off to this reciprocal scale, the 1 over scale, do your averaging there, and then take that average and come back.
So that is the effective population size of
The population size of a constant population that would get you the same net amount of genetic drift, the same net amount of change of identity by descent.
Is that a contemporary or the long-term average?
We're asking, since some starting point, how much genetic drift has accumulated by now. Whether it's contemporary depends on where you are. Are you sitting at the end or are you sitting at the beginning? I mean, are you sitting at the beginning asking what's going to happen, or are you sitting at the end asking what did happen? Could be either. You could be looking at it either way. But in any case, you'd have this formula. Okay, I've run this out, and then the people are, the howling mob is outside hammering on the door. So